It was, in short, the largest wartime propaganda campaign in the history of the United States. Central to the committee's propaganda were two basic ideas. One, the American homeland was in imminent danger from a savage, bloodthirsty foe. And two, it was the fate of the American nation, in President Wilson's words, to make the world safe for democracy. The first thing was a time-honored tactic long used in the United States and other countries to vilify foreign enemies, indigenous peoples, and slaves. During the Great War, the savage Indian and the subhuman Negro would transform into the barbaric Hun. The caricature of the bloodthirsty Hun was bolstered by a series of fake news reports leaked by the new propaganda industry and disseminated to the public. Among them, the babies in Belgium had had their hands cut off, were being impaled on bayonets, and in one case, nailed to a door. That a Canadian had been crucified by German soldiers, and that dead bodies were being boiled down in so-called corpse factories to be used for ammunitions and pig food. In a foreshadowing of the Freedom Fries incident, sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage. False atrocity stories would become a staple for nations in wartime throughout the 20th century. The recent example occurred prior to the first Gulf War.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
As it turns out, the massacre of babes never occurred. The young girl was actually a member of the Kuwaiti royal family and had been coached by the public relations firm Hill and Knowlton to give persuasive false testimony.
Kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
The attempt to engender hatred against Germans in support of the war effort was highly successful. But there was another, equally important aspect to the domestic propaganda campaign. If every adventure story needs a villain, it also needs a hero.
Now this is a song I made about when they're drafting the men. Uncle Sam say he traveled east and traveled west. Uncle Sam say he believed he know the best. Uncle Sam said, got to bottle love and go. I'll travel east, travel west.
Creel estimated that 72 million copies of 30 different booklets about American ideals were sent across the United States, with millions more sent abroad. In addition to influencing the minds of Europeans, the goal was to redefine for the home population the very concept of what it meant to be American. The new American would not interpret events from what Creel called a class or sectional standpoint, but rather as a unified collective. In this manner, the people could be herded into one white-hot mass instinct. Previously, military action by the United States had been justified under the pretense of maintaining order, protecting American interests, and bringing civilization to the savages. Now, the word civilization would transmute into democracy.
Sam say you don't have to hesitate, Uncle Sam say. You got it by love and go. Next number's called 192.
Morris Berman, author of Dark Ages America.
Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian communications theorist, once said that if a fish could talk and you could ask a fish, what's the most obvious element of your environment? The last thing that the fish would say would be water. That's the last thing the fish would notice. And it's true about any culture. Those things that are most powerful and most obvious to an outsider don't get seen by the people swimming in that water. Americans as God's chosen people. This goes back to, as far as back to 1630, where John Winthrop on the Arabella, coming from England to the United States, said, "We're a city on a hill." It's not an accident that in the campaign, you know, debates and stumps of the recent candidates, you had Barack Obama actually saying that, "We are a city on a hill," as well as Sarah Palin. Ronald Reagan said it in his inaugural address.
I've spoken of a shining city all my political life. but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace.
We're a city on a hill. And so our mission is to democratize the rest of the world. We've got the best system possible. And basically, people ought to pay attention to us because we know.
The idea of a particular state cast a savior of the world would be taken to new heights in the United States. But it wasn't an American invention. The savior motif was used as a justification for virtually every imperial intervention during the colonial era. French leaders spoke of a civilizing mission in their new colonies. British leaders spoke of bringing progress and civilized government to India. Imperial Japan spoke of unleashing an earthly paradise in Asia, while the Third Reich dreamt of a worldwide utopia. A decade before World War I, Mark Twain stated that my kind of loyalty was loyalty to one's country, not to its institutions or its office holders. Decades later, George Orwell came to a similar conclusion, that patriotism is a devotion to a certain place and people, contrary to nationalism, which is inseparable from lust for power. This concept of patriotism remains elusive.
Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
Michael Parenti, historian.
Equating super patriotism with militarism, military endeavor, military achievements, military struggles and victories, that's all supposedly a special manifestation of super patriotism. And I argue that a real patriot wants something different for his country. He wants social justice, he wants peace and stability, he wants fairness, he wants an end to racism and sexism. He takes pride in his country's ability at social betterment rather than his country's ability to invade and knock around other countries. A real patriot feels an attachment to his country, but not at the expense of other countries. He or she may feel a special attachment to the history of his own country. He values the accomplishments of his country, like the abolition of slavery, emergence of collective bargaining, and the rights of working people for a better life, the gains made by women in terms of being able to get into public life. These are the kind of things that the real patriot would value.
In October 2001, George W. Bush signed into law what civil libertarians characterized as an all-out assault against the Bill of Rights. It was called the Patriot Act. During the Great War, similar bills were passed. The Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act, passed a year later, authorized huge fines and lengthy prison terms for anyone who obstructed the military draft or encouraged what was termed disloyalty to the state. The sweeping legislation was quickly put into effect. And first on the list were the Wobblies.
Sharon Smith, historian.
In many ways, the Wobblies were the most impressive example of a union movement in the history of the U.S. working class. Wobblies was the nickname for an organization called the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, which flourished in the first decade and a half of the 20th century. The American Federation of Labor, which was the main craft union at the time, refused to organize African Americans, immigrants, and women workers. So that meant excluding the vast majority of the working class from the union movement. Along come the Wobblies, and they set out from the beginning specifically to organize immigrants, women, African Americans alongside white workers in what they called one big union. They led some of the most successful strikes. One of their strikes was the first sit-down strike at the time. Women workers played leadership roles, something that was absolutely unheard of at the time. Their philosophy was a revolutionary philosophy. It's known as anarcho-syndicalism.
A federated, decentralized system of free associations incorporating economic as well as social institutions would be what I refer to as anarcho-syndicalism, and it seems to me that it is the appropriate form of social organization for an advanced technological society in which human beings do not have to be forced into the position of tools, of cogs in a machine.
On September 5th, 1917, federal agents raided offices of the Wobblies across the nation, leading to arrests for the offense of causing insubordination, disloyalty, and refusal of duty in the military and naval forces. 101 of the defendants were found guilty and received prison sentences up to 20 years.
Wilson carried out a brutal internal repression called the Red Scare, which is the worst in American history, far worse than McCarthy, far worse than anything that's going on now. They arrested thousands of people, smashed the labor movement, heavy constraints on free expression, threw lots of people in jail, you know, expelled all sorts of people from the country.
Yet what had started as a hunt against radicals soon spread to every corner of American society. Patriots were encouraged to inform on friends and neighbors who spoke out against the war, while surveillance increased dramatically, not only by the military, but by seemingly benign institutions like the postal system.
The state flourishes in time of war. The state grows stronger in time of war. The state accumulates power. The military is enhanced. The forces of repression are enhanced. War is an opportunity for the government to grow in power.
By the time the war ended, the total number of deaths had reached approximately 9.7 million soldiers, with millions more suffering life-changing injuries and severe post-traumatic stress. To what end was not clear. The massive bloodshed had not made the world safe for freedom and democracy. What it had done was produce enormous fortunes for a handful of corporations and banks, while leaving the worldwide labor movement in disarray. If the Great War had been a test of the Constitution, and the concept of balancing the powers by each other, it failed. The United States Supreme Court, established in Schenck v. United States and Abrams v. United States, that the federal government could suspend constitutional rights when the nation faced, quote, a clear and present danger. Randolph Bourne, speaking of the Great War as a whole, responded preemptively with a now famous dictum. War, he said, is the health of the state.
William Robinson, editor of Critical Globalization Studies.
The definition of polyarchy that we have in the social sciences is a system where the participation of masses of people is limited to voting among one or another representatives of the elite in periodic elections. And in between elections, the masses are now expected to keep quiet, to go back to life as usual, while the elite make their decisions and run the world until they can choose between one or another elite another 4 years later. So really, polyarchy is a system of elite rule, and a system of elite rule which is a little more softcore than the type of elite rule that we would see under a military dictatorship, for instance. But what we see is that under a polyarchy, the basic socioeconomic system does not change. It does not become democratized. Wealth is not redistributed downward. You don't see a more equitable redistribution of wealth and resources. So that's the key. Socioeconomic dictatorship and free elections. That's the prescription for polyarchy. Participatory democracy would see not only more participation of people in the running of their daily affairs, but it would see a democratization of the economy, a democratization of social relations.
In the 20th century, you can't really talk openly about rule by the rich. That doesn't sound nice. The devices that have been developed, propaganda devices, are rule by the more competent, the technocratic elite, the responsible people, the educated sectors. There's a huge literature on this, but maybe the primary source for the 20th century is the leading public intellectual of the 20th century in the United States, Walter Lippmann, highly respected commentator on public affairs, also a theorist of democracy.
During World War I, people who later emerged as sort of the founding fathers of modern communication research, modern communication applications, mass media applications, quite a number of them had worked as propagandists during World War I. often as relatively young people who were shaping their own ideas at the time. One of them was Walter Lippmann, and Lippmann has emerged really to this day as a leading intellectual light of a particular way of looking at society.
Today, Walter Lippmann is known as the Dean of American Journalism. Yet during the Great War, he had been chief leaflet writer and editor of a U.S. propaganda unit. He also served as secretary of the Inquiry, a quasi-intelligence agency. Before dealing with Lippmann's contributions to political theory, we first have to understand the forms of democracy that have characterized the United States and other Western nations since the age of the Great Revolutions. A leap forward from the age of monarchy, the new nation-states would nevertheless preserve the concept that wealthy elites had the right to rule over the mass of the population.
Well, it's done me a sight of good, coming forward in time like this, to see how wonderful things have turned out. But I wish I could take you back with me, back in time, back those 200 years when we were statin as a nation. I wish you could have seen this country then.
John Manley, historian.
George Washington was a slave owner. James Madison was a slave owner. Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. Importantly, Jefferson, who was the most democratic of the lot, wasn't at the Philadelphia Convention. He was ambassador to France, and he picked up a lot of radical ideas from the French Revolution, which didn't exactly endear him to people like Alexander Hamilton. The initial divide in American politics then it goes back to those roots. It's Jeffersonian Democrats against Federalists, the leader of whom, until he was killed by Burr, was Alexander Hamilton. Essentially a class struggle, a class conflict. Thomas Jefferson was, in fact, a fairly radical democratic thinker in his time. And clearly the Declaration's statement that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, was a powerful democratic statement. And although Jefferson would not have applied it to women or to Indians or to blacks, nonetheless, in all of those cases, those words would come back to be very serviceable for those groups in pushing civil rights and civil liberties forward in the United States from where Jefferson's statement left them. The problem with the Declaration of Independence was that once independence was won from Britain, then the question became one of governance. How were these former colonies of Britain to govern? What led immediately to the Constitutional Convention in 1787 were a series of uprisings by debtors, essentially, not just in Massachusetts. The most famous is, of course, the Shays Rebellion in 1786.
The American state was founded largely to get the Ohio Valley, largely to cross the Appalachians. The Constitution, to organize an army and money in order to conquer further lands more to the west. That's the origin of the USA. But to do that, the slave masters are not going to do the fighting. What they will do is hire poor people to do it. But when they don't pay the poor people, as they didn't pay Daniel Shays, Daniel Shays takes matters into his own hands in 1787 and goes to the courts and shuts down the courts because the courts were beginning to foreclose on the grounds that Daniel Shays and the other veterans from the American War of Independence did not have the money to pay back.
Debtor riots were happening throughout the 1780s, and they were sufficiently scary from the point of view of people with property that they had to do something about it. And what they did about it was essentially overthrow the Articles of Confederation and instill a much stronger, much more able government to protect the property interests that were in dire threat from the people, quote unquote. This was an elitist, you could almost say, coup d'etat, except there wasn't any strong central government to launch a coup against. They were really trying to set one up and protect it against majoritarian interests, especially economic interests, especially property interests, especially threats from people who didn't have much. First thing they did when they got to Philadelphia in 1787 was they locked the doors. The only reason we know what happened behind those closed doors were that people like James Madison kept extensive notes.
The American Constitution was formulated primarily by James Madison. He's the major framer of the Constitution, and he wanted to overcome what he called the tyranny of the majority. He said a primary goal of government is to ensure that the opulent are protected from the majority. So therefore he designed the Constitution in such a way that, as he put it, the wealth of the nation will be in charge. The more responsible set of men, those who sympathize with property owners and their rights. And the system was designed that way. Power was in the Senate, which was the least representative body, and it was the wealth of the nation. In fact, it still is. The House of Representatives, which is more democratic, in theory, was given much less power. And the powerful executive is also supposed to represent the wealth of the nation. In Madison's defense, one should say that he was really pre-capitalist in his mentality. He assumed that the wealthy would be what he called benevolent gentlemen who would not be concerned with their own interests, but with the benefit of the people. Adam Smith, who preceded him, was much more realistic. He pointed out that the principal architects of policy, namely the merchants and manufacturers in his day, they ensure that the policies are designed so that their own interests are protected, no matter how grievous the effect on others, including the people of England. It's rather interesting to compare Madison's thinking, which founded this country, with the first major book on politics, namely Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle surveyed many kinds of systems and decided that of all of them, didn't like any of them, but he said of all of them, democracy is probably the best. But he said that democracy has a problem, and it was the same problem that Madison noticed centuries later. He said if in Athens everyone had a right to vote, the poor majority would attack the property of the rich, insist that it be divided, and he also felt that was unfair. But Madison and Aristotle had opposite solutions. Madison's solution was to restrict democracy. Aristotle's solution was to restrict inequality.
Opponents of the new government were called anti-federalists, though the term is inaccurate. The majority favored some form of federation, but insisted on more localized control with a more participatory democratic system.
The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, they were the price the Federalists had to pay in the ratifying conventions to pass the document. So the democratic element of the Constitution, which of course is the Bill of Rights, was forced down their throats. It didn't come out of Philadelphia at all. It was appended in 1791 and forced down on the Constitution by the more democratic elements in the society. Even with the Bill of Rights, we have a system which, you know, is hardly perfect from the point of view of civil rights and civil liberties, let's put it mildly. They've trampled all over with the rights of citizens. So the Bill of Rights is hardly an ironclad set of guarantees for civil rights and civil liberties in the United States. But I'd hate to think of the United States without it. The anti-federalists were significantly more partial to democratic elements in the society and to the rights of ordinary people than were the significantly more elitist federalists.
If the greatest legacy of the anti-federalists was the Bill of Rights, their dream of direct democracy was not to be. At the time, many dissidents made predictions for what they believed would come to pass as the new nation grew and flourished. The natural course of power is to make the many slaves to the few, one anti-federalist wrote. Another objected to the new government because the bulk of the people can have nothing to say to it. The government is not a government of the people. The men of fortune would not feel for the common people. An aristocratical tyranny would arise in which the great will struggle for power, honor, and wealth. The poor become a prey to avarice, insolence, and oppression. In short, my fellow citizens, it can be said to be nothing less than a nasty stride to universal empire. A significant model for both the Federalists and Anti-Federalists were the Iroquois, who had created a highly sophisticated and democratic federation of self-governing units. In stark contrast to European forms of government, the Iroquois people had the ability to immediately remove corrupt leaders. Women played a significant role in decision-making. Everyone was permitted to participate in debate and policy formulation.
Stephen Sacks, author of Remembering the Circle.
Native Americans were exceedingly democratic in the way they are. No society is perfect. When you make comparisons, you see that they were sometimes small, but sometimes 30, 40,000 people and more in a large confederacy that operated on a basis of mutual respect. Mutual respect that developed out of experience, because if you didn't treat people equally, then they were going to give you trouble. Societies were exceedingly collaborative, but they were also exceedingly individualist. The individual was honored, but the values were collaborative because you had to get along. Everybody was included in every decision that affected you. Elders obviously were honored. They knew more. You listened to your elders, but everybody had a say. You have an extremely participatory society, and as it moved up to larger, there's a great deal of decentralization. So if you had a large number of people, they would be in a federation. The village would decide for itself. The tribe would then decide, but the individual villages would have to decide. Then the tribes in the federation, their representatives would meet. But they wouldn't decide for everyone. They'd have to have the consensus of local people. So if there wasn't consensus already, they would have to go back and discuss it. So that to the extent that there was representation, these were representatives who were truly representative. They would have to go back. They wouldn't keep their positions unless they consulted people. And they knew that. Even if they had the authority to make a decision, people would go elsewhere and not keep them as leaders if they didn't listen to them and they didn't treat them. By and large, you had a much more participatory society, and even on the larger, more representative level, the representatives really had to listen to their constituencies.
Ironically referred to as primitive and savage, Native Americans had actually created a far more democratic system of self-governance than any civilized nation in history. But their anarchic models, as well as the more limited democratic systems proposed by the Anti-Federalists, were incompatible with Madison's elitist vision. In republic and parliamentary democracy alike, citizens would be reduced to passive observers. They would be allowed to pick and choose which individual made decisions on their behalf, but they would not be able to make those decisions themselves. Returning to the period after the First World War, we find widespread support amongst intellectuals for Madison's elitist interpretation of democracy. According to Walter Lippmann, the public's function in politics was to be interested spectators of action, but not participants. Yet Lippmann perceived a problem. New technologies in communication and transportation had awakened millions of disenfranchised people to a new world outside their towns and cities, while traditional economic, political, and social structures remained in place. Something had to change. But rather than advocate structural changes in society's institutions, Lippmann suggested that propaganda readjust the public mind.
In his essays on democracy in the 1920s, which are incidentally called Progressive Essays on Democracy, he was a Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy liberal in the American sense. He says that the majority are simply incompetent. They are ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, in his view. That's the majority of the population. And to allow them to participate in decision-making would be a complete disaster. So therefore, we have to design means to ensure that what he called the responsible men, of whom he was, of course, one, are protected from the roar and the trampling of the beasts, the ignorant majority. And he devised a number of methods. Lippmann called it the manufacture of consent. We have to manufacture the consent of the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, mass of the population. And the huge public relations industry was developed at the same time. They are the people who manage and control the marketing exercises that are called elections in the United States. They are marketing exercises, and they're well aware of it. For example, in the last election, 2008, the advertising industry gives a prize every year for the best marketing campaign of the year. 2008, they gave it to the Obama campaign, who beat out commercial competitors. The idea is we market candidates the same way we market toothpaste or lifestyle drugs or automobiles. Of course, it helps to have a lot of money. And in fact, Obama greatly outspent McCain, and not because of popular contributions. It came mostly from financial industries. He was their candidate, and his policies will presumably respond to his constituency.
Prominent intellectuals continue to argue that the world's complexity makes democracy impossible. A recent cover story in Time magazine claimed that democracy is in the worst interest of national goals. The modern world is too complex to allow the man or woman in the street to interfere in its management. A man who surely would have agreed was Edward Bernays. Like Lippmann, Bernays served as a propagandist on the Creel Committee, and like Lippmann, he went on to refashion wartime propaganda for peacetime aims. In his classic text, Propaganda, Bernays suggested that elites regiment the public mind every bit as much as an army regiments their bodies. Bernays considered mass mind control so crucial that it constituted, in his words, the very essence of the democratic process. Bernays' opportunity to shine arose when a crisis threatened not only the profits of major corporations, but the entire capitalist system. The solution, as theorized by business leaders, would lead to social breakdown, environmental catastrophe, and further alienation between the American people and their government. It would also lead to wealth on a scale never before imagined.
Sat Chaili, Media Education Foundation.
The major story that advertising tells us about human happiness is that the way through happiness is through the consumption of things. That, in fact, buying something in the marketplace will make you happy. That's the message of almost every single ad. And it's not often you can say that there is one message that is in the literally millions of ads that are produced every year. But I think that is the message. The message of advertising as a whole is that it's better to buy than not to buy. That, in fact, the way to become, and that you will be happier as a result of buying than not buying. And I think that idea, in fact, I think is the major force for global social change over the last 50 years.
In the 1920s, business leaders were faced with a dilemma. Overproduction of goods had exceeded demand. Production between 1860 and 1920 had increased by 12 to 14 times, while the population only increased by a factor of 3. There were several ways of solving the problem. One was to reduce working hours and raise wages so that production and consumption reach an equilibrium. This would have led to more leisure time for workers and a higher standard of living. The problem with this solution is that it could have entailed a slight decrease in profits. Corporations are mandated by law to maximize profits on behalf of their shareholders, regardless of social or environmental costs. According to business leaders, there was another problem. John Edgerton, president of the National Association of Manufacturers, warned that a shorter work week would undermine the work ethic and potentially foment radicalism. If people had time to stop and think, they might also take the time to rethink their position in life. The emphasis should be put on work, Edgerton stated. More work and better work, instead of upon leisure. It seems a harmless enough statement, but what businessmen were advocating was revolutionary. Production would no longer be about satisfying human needs. It would be an end, in and of itself. Rather than a democracy of ideas, or a democracy of mass participation, the United States would become a democracy of material goods. The citizen would be replaced by the consumer.
Look at those goods piled up over there. I'm worried. Here we are. We've got the new machines, and they're doing even better than we expected. They've not only cut production costs, but they've increased output over 50%. But we're not selling this additional product. Inventories are piling up. Now, what are we going to do about it?
It seems to me we've got to change our plan completely. Now that we're increasing production, we've got to put on more pressure, work the territory more intensively.
You mean more advertising?
Yes.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
The problem of capitalism is the problem of consumption. And the problem is that after your basic needs have been met, there is no real need for consumption. And so you have to convince people that, in fact, their identities are based upon the consumption of objects for which there is no material need. That's the problem that comes from the expansion of the market. If you look at advertising, it's a very interesting history. In the first period of advertising, yeah, we can say right up until about the 1920s, advertising talked about goods themselves. They talked about how they were made, what they did, how well they lasted, etc. It really is a discourse about objects, about what goods did. However, starting around 1920, that changes. And from that period on, advertising doesn't really talk about goods themselves. They talk about the relationship of goods to our needs.
At the center of the new strategy was Edward Bernays. If Walter Lippmann had concerned himself with an overarching analysis of mass media and democracy, Bernays would devote most of his energies to propaganda on behalf of the corporation. His uncle, Sigmund Freud, would serve as his muse. Rather than focus on the intrinsic worth of a particular product, Bernays suggested a strategy where products became linked with the unconscious desires of the public. In this manner, there would be virtually no limits to either production or consumption.
Freud's nephew was a man by the name of Bernays, and he's regarded as the father of modern public relations, particularly in the United States. His contribution, if you want to call it that, was to take propaganda techniques that had been developed for military, psychological warfare, national security type issues during World War I, and apply them in a systematic way to commercial issues. One of his best-known efforts had to do with encouraging females, women, to smoke. He would stage beauty pageants, he would stage what would today be called photo ops and that sort of thing, in which smoking by women was portrayed as women's liberation, was portrayed as a way to be free and empowered, is getting addicted to nicotine. The audience, the market, in Bernays's mind, had a clear desire to be free, to be stronger, to be more self-empowered. So women clearly wanted these things. Along comes Bernays in the tobacco industry and says, here is how to have it.
Goods don't make us very happy. Goods are not central to satisfaction. What actually really makes people happy are non-material things. What makes people happy seems to be things connected with sociability. I don't mean to say by that that material things have nothing to do with happiness. Poor people are not happy. They don't have access to, you know, to clean drinking water. They don't have access to food. They don't have access to shelter. So it's not that material things are not connected to happiness. They are to some degree. But once you get past a certain level of comfort, material things simply don't provide us happiness. At the same time, there is this giant propaganda system of advertising that is, again, perpetually telling us that the way to happiness is through objects, the way to happiness is through consumption. What makes people happy are things to do with society, with connection, with personal connection, with autonomy, with relaxation. In fact, when you ask people what it is that makes them happy, goods very rarely come into it. However, the problem is that capitalism has to sell goods. The marketplace provides goods, and therefore, what it did was it took the images of the life that people really want, which is a life of meaning, of connection, of sociability, of friendship, of family, of intimacy, of sexuality. Those are the images that it took, and it linked them to objects. And so advertising is both true and false at the same time. If it was simply false, you know, it wouldn't work. But advertising is true to the extent that it reflects our real desires.
As bizarre as it may sound for people who dream of fantastic wealth as a cure for unhappiness, the same holds for the wealthy. Beyond a certain level of material comfort, deprivation is relative.
At the bottom level, sure, it's $5 million to $10 million a year. But once you've got $5 or $10 million, that doesn't seem like enough because you're associated with people who have 15 or 20. And when you get 15 or 20, then it's 50 and 100. And you wind up never feeling as if you have enough. And in fact, people really never even thought of themselves as rich, even when they were colossally rich, because of this phenomenon that psychologists call relative deprivation. They were comparing themselves, not with you and me, but with each other in this little world that they've come to inhabit.
In his book, The Status Seekers, Vance Packard uses the phrase merchants of discontent to describe a deliberate strategy by advertisers of targeting the less affluent with status symbol messages. For someone with little chance of changing their social conditions in life, consumerism offers a quick fix that allows people to feel as though they are climbing the social hierarchy, when in fact, they are standing still. The strategy was particularly evident in mid-century automobile advertising. Studies found that people who lived in housing developments were more likely to park their cars outside of the garage than those who could afford more expensive homes. A typical example is this advertisement from Plymouth. It reads, "We're not wealthy, we just look it." The American way of life would be characterized by a myth which would seem to make political activism unnecessary. In the new democracy of material goods, there were an infinite number of possessions to be purchased by rich and poor alike. There was no need to change institutions because the system was already perfect. It was called the American Dream, and happiness was just one possession away.
Are young adults, and the shopping centers are built in their image. Selling to young adults demands a new kind of marketing. For these young adults, the shopping centers have built fountains, commissioned statues, put in restaurants, and freestanding stairways. They've included banks, loan offices, rental plans, plant nurseries, and places to buy building materials. The shopping centers see these young adults as people whose homes are always in need of expansion. People who buy in large quantities and truck it away in their cars. It's a big market.
In the tinsel and glitter world of Beverly Hills, superstars reign supreme in million-dollar mansions that hold a weird fascination for everyone else. Visitors rubberneck for hours just for a glimpse through the guarded gates. But for one man already on the ladder to superstardom, just a look wasn't enough. For him, it was love at first sight.
Morris Berman.
We just had, at the time of this filming, it was just a few days ago, there was an incident at a Walmart in Long Island the day after Thanksgiving, where basically people were lining up for a sale, 5 in the morning, and one of the workers there was crushed to death, was actually trampled to death by these shoppers. And when the ambulance arrived or whatever it was to take the poor guy to the morgue or the hospital or wherever they're going to take, they didn't want to get out of the way. They said, "I've been waiting here for 5 in the morning. I'm not leaving." So that would be the consumer society at its finest. And oddly enough, exactly to the day 5 years ago, on that day, a day after Thanksgiving, the same thing happened at a Walmart in Orlando. It was not a worker, it was a woman who was shopping there. And she wasn't killed, but she was trampled unconscious, and people wouldn't get out of the way for the medics to take her away. So when you get finally to that point, this is what Marcuse was talking about, and the whole idea of one-dimensional man and so on, was this tremendous emptiness again. And so I'm going to buy things to fill that emptiness up. And then we see the religious power of it, because if the medics arrive basically to take the corpse away or the body of the hospital, and you're not going to get out of the way because you're going to save $50 on a DVD player, that suggests something has gone fundamentally wrong.
Images of huge people in a huge shopping complex engaged in what would appear to be a life and death struggle for possession of consumer items.
I think there's not much difference between assuaging your anxiety by buying things and investing in the American dream. They seem to go hand in hand.
The American dream is a story about how society works. The American dream says that if you work hard, you will succeed.
Now, the bedrock of our economic success is the American dream. It's a dream shared in big cities and small towns across races, regions, and religions that if you work hard, you can support a family. That if you get sick, there will be health care that you can afford. That you can retire. That you can retire with the dignity and security and respect that you've earned, that your children can get a good education and young people can go to college even if they don't come from a wealthy family.
And so he says, we might start off with different positions. There are people who are rich and there are people who are poor, and they're born into different kind of contexts, but the playing field is level. That's the dream. That's the dream of, you know, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. The problem with that is that is actually at odds with how social mobility works. Social mobility actually is much more based upon class and upon the resources that you have available to you into which you're born.
Hi, I'm Paris Hilton, and you're here for the fit on MySpace. Let's go check out my shoe closet first. So welcome to my shoe closet. As you can tell, I really love shoes.
Part of those are material resources, and part of those are also cultural resources as well. There are class structures that keep people mostly in their places. There are some slight exceptions to this, where there's movement between, you know, one rung and another, but the level of social mobility is remarkably low in the society. And then the American dream is punctuated by these very visible examples in the media that show us people who are poor who are now rich. And now the question is, if those people are rich, if those people have made it, and a vast majority of the people have not, and the major thing that separates them is their own hard work, then the reason that the vast majority of people are where they are is because that is where they deserve to be. You didn't work hard enough. You're not intelligent enough.
The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Some are smart, some not. Some are successful, some not.
The United States never had mass prosperity throughout its history. It was just a period from 1946 to 1980 where the prosperity was really, it looked like it was just going better and better and better for everybody. And that came after World War II with the backlog of tremendous earnings from war industry and such, the GI Bill that came in that developed a whole new big professional class and the like. And that lasted till about 1980. Since then, there have been cutbacks to human services, cutbacks in educational opportunities, and greater inequality. Since 2000 to 2008, the inequality between the very rich and the rest of us, that inequality is greater than it's been throughout the 20th century. So we're back to like 1900 in terms of inequality. Everybody just can't make it. Throughout history, the rich have always argued that the poor are the authors of their own poverty. They're poor because they're stupid, they're disreputable, they're hopeless. People are poor because they are paid less than the value that they produce. You need poverty. Poverty is needed if you're going to have wealth. The only way a rich slaveholder, a Roman senator, or antebellum plantation owner in the South, the only way they can live in this fabulously luxurious mode is by having slaves who work from the crack of dawn down into the night. That's expropriation. That's creating the poverty of the slave or the serf or the worker so that the slaveholder or the lord, the feudal lord, or the plutocrat, the capitalist, can really accumulate wealth.
The idea that human happiness is connected to the immense accumulation of commodities. I think that idea is what is driving development in what we used to call the developed world, is driving development in China, is driving development in India. I think it will increasingly drive development in Africa as well. I think we're starting to see the results of what that means for the planet. When not only, you know, the 5% of the American population strives for that, but when increasingly the rest of the world also is bought into that, and you then have to provide the goods and the energy that those goods take to produce, we're arriving at the kind of exhaustion of the physical planet. The ancient philosopher Confucius, he was asked what he would do if he were ever to rule the state. Someone said, okay, you're in charge of the state, what would you do? And he said a very interesting thing. He said he would, quote, rectify the language. And I think if he was asked that in the modern age, he would say, let me control the media. If you can control the stories, you don't need to have soldiers on the street corners to control them. You can control people in their own heads, in their own imaginations. On the one hand, it's really depressing because it's like how do you then get out of it? Because there's no way you can have control of the media. There's no way you can compete with these stories that are told thousands of times a day through advertising, through programming, through newspapers, through the internet now, through video games, through all kinds of ways. At the same time, the reason I'm hopeful, the reason actually gives me some optimism is that capitalism has to do that. That unless it does that, they know that things will fall apart. So capitalism in that sense is like a house of cards. House of cards that has to be constantly held together. We have to be told every single day what this story is. And they have to do it every day because it's unnatural. If it was natural, they wouldn't have to do it. And if they stop, they know that in fact it would fall apart. That actually is the great hope for me. Is in fact the amount of time they have to spend convincing us about the value of this society is in fact what gives me hope that that there's an alternative just below the surface, and that alternative is much more human, much more compassionate, is much more connected to concern for other people, is much more connected to concern for the planet, and that it's being held down by this incredible and relentless propaganda system.
If a decision is made by a centralized authority, it's going to represent the interests of a particular group in power. If power is actually rooted in large parts of the population, if people can actually participate in social planning, then they will presumably do so in terms of their own interests. Now, that's why Madison, for example, and Lippmann, and Bernays, and a whole host of others have argued that we cannot permit the population to participate. Because if they do, they will pursue their own interests, not the interests of the wealth of the nation. If you have centralized power, they'll use it for their own interests. You don't have to read that in a complicated textbook. It should be understandable by any 10-year-old child, not by educated people, though they have it driven out of their heads, have various illusions replacing self-serving illusions. If the population are participants, they'll serve their own interests. Public opinion is very well studied, so we have a wealth of information about what the public wants. And there's a huge disconnect between public opinion and public policy. The public and policymakers differ enormously on crucial issues. It's all very natural. It's nothing surprising about it, and people understand it. So about 80% of the population in the United States says that the government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves.
What do you mean by democracy? If you mean by democracy a system that accepts that the relative distribution of power and influence and wealth and income in the society is sacrosanct, if the social system we call and know as capitalism is inviolable, and you can't, in fact, erode or undercut the primacy of that class's power and property politically, then you've just ruled out democracy. The founders had a very clear idea that in order for political power to be democratic and to be equal, economic power also had to be democratic and equal, okay? And that was the last thing they wanted. So they saw clearly that behind political democracy was economic democracy. Behind political equality was economic equality. And they did everything they could to block it.
The claims of mind control are based on a belief that human beings are powerless or relatively powerless when they become the targets of psychological operations and propaganda. Media control, yeah, it has an impact on public opinion, without a doubt. It has an impact on the assumptions that people bring to trying to figure out what to do in their lives. It's powerful, but it's not the same as mind control. I think the best way to stop propaganda is for people to understand what it is and how it works. I don't think we're going to stop propaganda so long as we have freedom of speech. And frankly, I think that's a good thing for us. But there will always be people who exploit freedom of speech for their own ends. But propaganda loses its effectiveness if people understand what is going on. A very important thing that can be done to reduce the power of propaganda is to force the players to the surface, so that where you have campaigns, political campaigns, product campaigns, cultural campaigns that are organized by big propaganda agencies, public relations agencies, then part of the task for people who are observing this going on is to make this public, make it understood that what's appearing on the front page of the Washington Post, for example, really is a propaganda or public relations campaign that's coming from a particular faction of society who are paying for it, and that they have names.
It depends on what people believe, what people perceive, what people know. And for a democracy to really function and thrive, unlike Eddie Bernays, I would say what we need is more information, more freedom, more transparency, and more information about who's manipulating public opinion and the public mind. Eddie Bernays believed that fundamentally people were unable to govern themselves in a democracy because most of us were just too dumb to figure it out. And so he used that to justify his practice that he exalted of managing and manipulating public opinion. I think actually what we need is a lot more exposure and education about how public opinion is managed and manipulated, so that we have a citizenry that can actually function and be critical thinkers and decision makers and govern ourselves in a democracy. Clearly, individual and public opinion is crucial to everything. As long as you can manage and manipulate public opinion, or as Burson Marsteller likes to put it, public perception, you can control public behavior and policy. That's what Eddie Bernays knew. That's what he was saying when he talked about engineering consent. And so, yeah, I believe that the ultimate battlefield really is in the mind.
In this dark heat, that robbing the rich is coerce or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way.
This week's main film, Cywar, is available from metanoia-films.org. An interesting link with Metanoia, as mentioned by Jim Douglas last week. The other media used for this episode are at unwelcomeguests.net/518. The show has a mailing list at altruist.org/unwelcome, or you can email me directly at unwelcome@altruists.org. If you feel like giving feedback, I'd love to hear what you make of the show. Theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can, and don't believe the hype.
Unwelcome travelers, another brave